Okay, the first thing to recognize here is that relevance is a relationship between propositions or statements or claims. A claim has positive relevance for another if its being true makes the other more likely to be true. And it has negative relevance if its being true makes the other less likely to be true. So two claims are irrelevant if their truth value has no bearing upon one on the other. Okay, there's a standard name for fallacies of irrelevance that are called non sequiturs. So if you commit a non sequitur, you draw a conclusion from premises that are irrelevant. Non sequitur in Latin just means it does not follow. Okay, one classic fallacy of relevance is called the red herring. In a red herring, the strategy is to lead your opponent off the track. Now, the name comes from escaped criminal who, let's say that the police and the bloodhounds are on his track. He would have a confederate would drag a herring. The herring's a fish. It's supposed to be a rather smelly kind of fish. Drag this red herring across the path, and it would lead the dogs off the track. So what happens here is that you commit a red herring when there's a subtle change in the issue being discussed. Now, it has to be a related issue, or it's not going to throw anybody off the track. It's different but related. So to determine whether something's a red herring, just ask yourself, is the issue at the beginning of the argument the same as the issue at the end of the argument? Here's an example. The American Cancer Society has argued that smoking is bad for your health. Many people in the southeastern United States are dependent upon the tobacco industry for their jobs. Making smoking illegal would have a devastating economic effect on many states. Therefore, the American Cancer Society is simply wrong. Now, the original issue at the beginning was whether smoking had bad health consequences. And the issue at the end is whether canceling smoking is going to have a negative economic impact. Okay, another fallacy of relevance is called the horse laugh. In the horse laugh, there's no real response to the original argument. You just ridicule the position, like nobody would believe that, or if you believe that, you're crazy, or so on. Now, a famous fallacy is called an ad hominem. It should be 1G, not 2, and against. Yeah, the fallacy against the person. So you commit an ad hominem when you attack the person who gives you the original argument rather than address the argument itself. When you commit an ad hominem, really what you do is divert the attention away from the weakness of your response and address or focus the attention upon the person giving the argument. Here are four types of ad hominems: personal attack, circumstantial ad hominem, a pseudo-refutation, also in Latin called tu quoque for you too, and poisoning the well. First is the personal attack. In the personal attack, you say something bad about the person's character or history. The example here is, I know that the senator has argued against increased defense spending, but you should know that he is an alcoholic that abuses his dog. Okay, so his argument should be rejected. Now, we haven't given any reasons for rejecting the original argument. We haven't really responded to the argument. We've just said, this is this kind of person, so you shouldn't listen to him. A common kind of personal attack is just using labels. So-and-so is a liberal. So-and-so is a fascist. Okay, a circumstantial ad hominem is when you base the attack upon the individual situation. This is almost always a charge of bias or vested interest on the part of the person giving the argument. Now, in the previous lecture, it talked about how you, in the one on experts, you always have to be careful and ask yourself, does this person have a vested interest? So having a vested interest gives you a reason to suspect the argument, but doesn't give you a reason to just dismiss it. So if a person has a vested interest, you have to look very, very closely at the reasons they've offered and check to see if they're true. But if the reasons are good and if the data is good, then the argument stands on its own. It does give you your reason to check it closely. So, example, Fred's argument against gun control laws should be dismissed. Of course, he'd object to those laws, as employer's largest firearms dealer in the state. Well, Fred may have given us a very, very good argument. Now, of course, he does have a reason to be preferring his position, so we have to check to make sure that his facts are straight. But if they are, then we ought to accept his position. Okay, third kind is called a pseudo-refutation. This is a charge of inconsistency on the part of the person giving the argument. I should reject what you're telling me because essentially you don't live as if that's true. So I shouldn't be concerned about excess fat in my diet because I know, you know, how much bacon you eat during the week, so on like that. You're urging that the argument be dismissed because it's inconsistent with with things that the person says or does. Okay, an argument is an instance of poisoning the well if it's really an ad hominem that you commit before the person says anything. Okay, so the intent is to get the listener to reject the person's argument even before they say it. Example: don't listen to what the next speaker is going to say. She works for a company that's being investigated. So the key here is what makes it poisoning the well. It's that it's the next speaker. She hasn't said anything yet. Okay, straw man. A straw man fallacy is when you distort the other position to make it appear unreasonable. You don't address the actual view. What you address is usually a weaker version of the actual view. So a way that straw man's often committed is that you make the conclusion appear more extreme than it actually is, because extreme views are generally easier to attack. The extremes are pretty vulnerable to attack. A sensible moderate position may be a lot stronger. For example, the senator has argued that there should be a mandatory waiting period before any handgun purchase. Well, obviously, he wants to make all firearm ownership illegal. Well, I mean, that's a really extreme view. It's pretty easy to show that it's bad. But we don't have any reason to believe that that's the view that he's maintaining. Okay, subtle versions of straw man fallacies are when you take words out of context, or you treat the extreme positions as representative of the whole view, or maybe the person has had an early version of the particular position. That early version had some weaknesses, and over the years they've modified their position so that it's a lot stronger, and you've just criticized the early version while ignoring the later stronger modifications. Or common example of straw man argument that, or straw man fallacy that's committed in a lot of papers written in college, is that you have a simplified version of the position that you're addressing in the paper, and you show that that's bad. So anytime that you criticize a deliberately simplified version, you're committing the straw man fallacy. Next fallacy is called an appeal to ignorance. You commit the appeal to ignorance when you believe that something is true simply because it hasn't been shown to be false. Vice versa, you believe that something's false simply because it's never been shown to be true. Now, in order for this to really be a fallacy, it's got to be the case that the burden of proof is on the other side. Okay. For example, no one's proved that there are no aliens, so they must exist. Well, that's not really a good reason to believe that aliens exist, just because nobody has proved that there are none. Now, burden of proof works like this. One side on an issue generally has the burden of proof. If you have the burden of proof, it's your responsibility to make the case. The other side doesn't have to make their case. They just win by default. Okay, here are the conditions that determine whether a side has the burden of proof. In general, all other things being equal, the less plausible side has the burden of proof. So if you've got two sides on this issue, A and B, if A were true, it'd really be surprising. It's not very plausible. If B is true, it wouldn't be surprising at all. Well, A has the burden of proof. They've got to make their case. Okay, the default position is B, the more plausible claim. In general, the side that makes the affirmative claim has the burden of proof. So, especially with the existence claims. So a person who says let's say two people are having an argument about the existence of unicorns. One side says there are unicorns, and the other says there are no unicorns. Well, which side should have the burden of proof? It seems like the side that says there are no unicorns, well, in order for them to conclusively prove their case, they've got a whole lot of work to do. In fact, it's probably impossible for them to conclusively prove their case. Somebody could say, well, there are no unicorns. Do you see any unicorns? And the other side would say, well, of course there are no unicorns here in the middle of Oklahoma. Unicorns don't live in Oklahoma. They live over in Europe. You go over there, and no unicorns there. So you look around, and they say, well, these unicorns are really, really smart. In fact, when they know somebody's looking for them, they hide really well. Or these unicorns can turn themselves invisible. Or just because there are no unicorns on Earth, maybe they live on another planet, so on. So there's nothing that this person who denies the existence of unicorns can do to the satisfaction of the other side. Now, if a person believes that there are unicorns, they could easily prove their case if it were true. All they'd have to do is produce one. So that side, since they have the easier case to make if it's true, they have the burden of proof. Okay, now these are called ceteris paribus conditions, which means that all other things being equal. So all other things being equal, the less plausible side has the burden of proof. All other things being equal, the side that makes the affirmative claim has the burden of proof. Now, sometimes not all things are equal. Sometimes these two conditions can conflict. Sometimes less plausible side is the denial, not the affirmative side. For instance, somebody might say, well, I believe that there are no more undiscovered species of insects. And somebody could say, well, yeah, you know, I believe certainly there are undiscovered species of insects. Well, one of those is a lot more plausible than the other. In fact, the affirmative claim is much more plausible, and probably in this case, the negative claim has the burden of proof. Okay, you commit a fallacy when you place the burden of proof on the wrong side. Okay, here's a special case where burden of proof comes up. In the law, there's always this presumption of innocence, so you're innocent until proven guilty. That means that the prosecution always has the burden of proof. The defense doesn't have to prove that the defendant is innocent. The prosecution has to prove that the defendant is guilty. Now, there's a difference between burden of proof and standard of proof. The burden of proof never changes in our legal system. The prosecution always has the burden of proof. Now, the standard of proof differs. The standard of proof is to what extent does the prosecution have to make its case. In a criminal case, the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. That means, although it's sort of a vague definition, that means there's some very high degree of probability that the prosecution has to make its case too. Now, this is not beyond a shadow of a doubt. They don't have to conclusively prove it. But any reasonable person would have to believe that the defendant is guilty. In civil cases, there are several different standards of proof in civil cases depending on what kind of case it is. First is called clear and convincing evidence. In clear and convincing evidence, this usually involves civil cases where you're giving up certain rights, or where you stand to lose certain important interests. This is less than beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's more than the next level of standard of proof. Next level is preponderance of evidence. This is a balance of probabilities. You've shown that given the evidence, it's just more likely that the defendant did it than not. And the last is probable cause. You've got some reason to believe that this person is guilty. This is used by grand juries, or it's used to determine whether or not a search warrant or an arrest warrant should be issued. Now, before we go on to this next one, this difference in standard of proof, is the reason why you go back to a famous case a few years back, O.J. Simpson trial. O.J. is found innocent in criminal court, but he's found liable in a civil suit. What happened is that the jury determined essentially that the standard of proof was not met in the criminal trial, but a lower standard of proof was met in the civil case. Okay, you commit a fallacy of suppressed evidence when you ignore evidence that's relevant to the conclusion. So, relevance is an issue in two ways in reasoning. One, you have reasons offered that are in fact irrelevant. The second is when you don't offer certain information that is relevant. Okay, the second occurs a lot in inductive arguments. Now, if you think about the difference between deduction and induction, in a deductive argument, if you have a deductively valid argument, any more information that you argue that you offer isn't going to make it invalid. Okay, so let's say you have a deductively valid argument with two premises and a conclusion. Okay, for instance, all dogs are mammals. Lassie's a dog, therefore Lassie's a mammal. Now, if I add three more premises to that argument, it's still going to be deductively valid because those first two premises were enough to guarantee the truth of the conclusion. There's no more information that I can add that's gonna make those two premises not guarantee the truth of that conclusion. Okay, in an inductive argument, though, you can have an inductive argument that's pretty weak. But I add more premises, I can make it stronger and stronger and stronger. Or I can add more premises to a strong inductive argument and make it a pretty weak inductive argument. So induction, it can change. So for example here, imagine some sampling study where 8 out of 10 people surveyed say that church attendance is not important for spirituality. Well, and then later you found out that they conducted this study by polling, telephoning households between 11 and 12 on Sunday morning. Well, it would seem like most of the people who believe that church attendance is important were not available to answer the phone. So here's a case where what looks like a pretty strong inductive argument, given more information, turns out to be a pretty weak inductive argument. Well, that's the end of the section on relevance, and we have some more fallacies in the next lecture.